Welcome to the Flying Solo Podcast. I am your host, Katie Kangas, and each week on the show, we will talk about how to take flight and follow your dreams as a solopreneur architect. In this episode, I talk with Sam Williams about residential practice. Sam works with clients whose home remodels and additions are not too big and not too small. He loves problem solving within the constraints of an existing home. His approach is much like a nuthatch. A nuthatch is a small tree-climbing songbird. It typically climbs headfirst down trees, giving it a unique perspective of the world. A nuthatch finds insects underneath branches and tree knots, places woodpeckers and other upward-facing birds miss. Sam uses his unique perspective to serve clients whose projects are missed by other architects, who are only looking for bigger or simpler projects. Sam serves a unique niche within his community, helping families thrive by strategically remodeling their home. Sam Williams, welcome to the Flying Solo Podcast.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Can you tell me a little bit about where you're practicing and the name of your firm?
So my firm is Kraft Architecture. I am in Franklin, Massachusetts, which is about 45 minutes southwest of Boston. And I am primarily a residential architect focused on renovations, additions, and accessory dwelling units.
How did you come up with that specialty?
So when I first started, I was actually moonlighting. I worked at a company that does what I call the most boring architecture humanly possible. It was a design build company focused on food and beverage industrial projects. So like basically giant refrigerated boxes. Interesting.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Interesting from a building science perspective. Not interesting from a design perspective at all. And so it was a little soul sucking. So I was looking for something like a little bit more architecture-y. And also growing up, my father was and is a general contractor. So I'd always sort of had like residential architecture, like in my, you know, or like residential work, sort of like in my blood, I guess. So I'd always wanted to pursue that avenue, and I'd always wanted to go out on my own, and I figured that was sort of going to be the easiest avenue to do that. And then as I got into things, I tried to take on a couple of commercial projects here and there, or, you know, like some other stuff outside of residential, and just realized very quickly that if I got outside that focus, I was not as productive. I couldn't deliver the product that I hoped to deliver. And so getting into sort of the residential and specifically renovations, additions, I just realized that my delivery would be a lot better if I just focused on those things and just kept it sort of niche and simple and had a repeatable delivery each time that, you know, I wasn't trying to like go off and do like this one-off commercial fit out where I had to do a code study and this and that and things like that. It was just easier to do the residential stuff. I knew, you know, I didn't have to go and look everything up. I sort of just knew what I was talking about and where things were going. It was a lot easier delivery, and I just enjoyed it more as well. So
tell me more about how you feel about that residential deliverable. Is it more of that conversational and it's meeting based versus the heavy multiple stages and multiple contractors? What is that big difference?
Yeah. So I think for me, the great part about residential is that it's sort of more, you're working in somebody's home, right? So it's just a much more personal, experience than working on like a tenant fit out for somebody or some other space. You're working on the place that these people live and they're going to be all the time. It's just, it's a much more, like personal and emotional experience. And I feel more comfortable in sort of those smaller conversations, like the, you know, having the one-on-one or the one-on-two with a couple of for a residential project, as opposed to, you know, in commercial, sometimes it's like by committee or, you know, like, yeah, there's more layers of, like decision-making and things like that, that you need to navigate. And obviously the process to get to, you know, like the reviews and stuff like that are just more cumbersome with commercial projects. And there's more to know. You know, if you're working IBC instead of IRC, it's, you know, there's a little bit more to it, a little bit more nuance and stuff like that. So, yeah, I just like the sort of the personal connection of working on residential projects versus the, versus commercial.
And what do you think about your own strengths as a designer and as an architect come out by being able to work on those kind of projects?
I work with a lot of clients that are, they're 35 to 50 years old. They've either, they're about to have a kid, they've got a couple kids, they're trying to search for a little bit more space. And that is sort of my lived experience, because I have three kids and I'm in a house that needs to expand. And I've worked on a lot of projects like that. I think I just have a very, like a practical approach to helping them problem solve those issues. And you know, like I have, you know, personal experience, but then I have the experience of working with a lot of clients who are trying to do what they're doing, to find space, or, you know, sometimes they don't know what they don't know. I was talking to a client yesterday and they're about to have their first, and we were talking about, you know, playroom space. And I told them, it's like, you can have a room that is named playroom, but the kids are going to play wherever you are. Everybody who has kids of that age, like, the thing they want the most is like mudroom storage space. You know, people come in the door, stuff is everywhere. The kids have tons of stuff. I think, and most of the people I work with are very, it's like sort of very middle, solidly middle class. I'm not doing like a lot of high end residential and stuff like that. So yeah, I think it's just a very practical approach, and you know, I make myself approachable. I put a picture of my family on my website, and so people can see that, like, I have some kids and I have some reviews online and stuff like that. But multiple people have told me, they're like, oh, we saw the picture of you with your family and we figured you were the right guy for us. And which I didn't know that that would be the selling point. It sort of like was a happy accident. My design approach is just to get people into like really practical solutions to their big problems, because everyone's got a finite amount of money and they're trying to get like as much as they can within their, you know, within their budget and just have really good value. And I think that's what I offer.
I love that. And I think I've got a bird for you because of that challenging problem solving brain. When you have to do these renovations and you're dealing with so many constraints and mm-hmm. trying to be very practical and in alignment, it reminds me of a nuthatch, mm-hmm. which is a bird that actually spends half its time upside down, looking at problems in different ways. So a woodpecker may go and just hammer away at trees, but a nuthatch is much more particular and very careful and is able to very minutely and delicately, like they're upwards or upside down, coming at these projects from every different way. To find that little space that you can fit things in. And I feel like that's a very practical backyard bird for you.
Yeah. Well, I saying that, I've realized that the projects that have constraints, you know, like the reason I like renovations and additions is because they do come with so many constraints. I've tried to do new construction projects before. And when I do those, they're sort of, you know, they can go anywhere, right? Like you have a sort of more of a blank canvas, and I struggle with that because it's almost like, oh, there are too many options. I've got to explore them all. And I need the, sort of the constraints to keep me guided. And I think I work better in that, like with some parameters, some guardrails.
Yeah. Yes. The guardrails are great.
Yeah.
It's a great niche because not everyone wants to tackle all those challenges. And
right.
not everyone is ready to like find how do you fit a mudroom between a garage and an entry when it's already built. You don't cars are only getting bigger, and yeah. there's some interesting solutions you start to discover as you work on that specific project type. I love that.
Yeah, for sure. I've noticed, like, because of where I'm sort of positioned in my market, like, I feel like there's a lot of architects who only want to work on more high end stuff. And then there's a lot of designers or like contractors that do design build that aren't giving people enough of design. So I'm sort of fitting myself in between those two, where they're getting good design, but they're not like they're not paying for this really high end design that's going to be like, you know, I'm getting them as much as they need to be able to get their project built and not giving them like a ton of extras and stuff like that that you would get from working with one of the like really high-end architects. I get people, you know, I give them a couple schematic design options. We go through those, you know, go through a little design development process, and then I give them permanent construction drawings, but then leave them to pick fixtures and finishes and stuff like that with either an interior designer or with their contractor. And the idea being that if I'm giving the contractor this permit set that has the information they need, but then they can work together to pick out the fixtures and finishes, the contractor can control the budget in that way. So that way they can make sure that they, you know, get the things they want and it fits where they need to be value and budget wise. I do feel like I'm not competing against a ton of people because I fit sort of in this middle ground where there are not a lot of folks operating.
And I think it's a great place to be because there are so many of those bigger projects where architects, you're always picking those fixtures and finishes. And then it's always an extra cost in CA because people change their mind or the budget changes or
yep.
tile goes out of production and you don't yep. have enough. And so it's already something that tends, not always, but tends to be designed at least twice in my yep. experience.
Yeah.
Even as careful as we are,
you can't control
the industries that are producing these things. So it's a careful approach, it's a cautious approach, but giving them the value where they need it, because a lot of times it's that storage, it's that function, and
yeah.
people have not seen the solutions that architects can come up with that just improve their life, and you
yeah.
find the space where they may not think they have it.
Yeah.
It's very valuable.
Yeah. Sometimes people come to me and they'll be like, oh, I have a plan. And I just like, I have this idea of what I want and I just need someone to draw it. And I'm like, that's, you know, like I'm going to be a very expensive draftsperson. But if you
yeah.
need someone to help you solve a problem, I have immense value, you know, like that's where the value is. So, I try to find those clients who are like, I have this concept, you know, like I have this problem, right? It's like, I need this space or I need this to be different, whatever, but I don't know how. And then I help them explore the ways that it can be different or we can solve their problem. And I always try to give them multiple options. Like I do this thing where I tell people, it's like, we're going to throw a bunch of stuff at the wall and we're going to see what sticks for you. What is the best approach for you? Because, you know, a lot of people have very similar problems, but want different solutions to those problems. You know, so like people just, everyone has their own idiosyncrasies and, you know, things that they're particular about. So just finding what that, you know, there's always more than one way to skin a cat, as I say. So finding the right solution for that person, even though sometimes the problems are pretty similar across the board. Sometimes people have unique problems, and you gotta figure out how to solve those too. But I find with my client type in the, like the housing stock that I'm working on, a lot of the problems are pretty similar,
mm-hmm.
which is good because it makes my job, you know, like it's like, oh, I've seen this before. Like I have a couple ideas of how we can solve this, and we just have to pick which one is the one for you.
It's really fun to be honing your skills and your design expertise in that way. And it keeps it fresh when new problems come along.
Yeah.
You mentioned finding clients who are looking for more than drafting.
Yep.
To use your full value, but less than the concierge service of full design down to the cabinetry base and selecting fixtures. What are you doing to find the people who align with your mission?
So it mostly, when I first started, it was almost 100% word of mouth. I ended up, the first project I did was like for a friend of a friend, and that was sort of the deliverable we gave them. And then that person ended up giving my name to like four other people. And the builder that I worked with on that project, I have now done probably 30 projects with in 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah, he's like that builder, he had been partnered with another guy before that and they split off and he ended up doing his own thing. And that my first like real project was also his first real project, like on his own. And so him and I have sort of worked in tandem a little bit. So I refer a lot of people to him. He refers a lot of people to me. And so we both have an understanding of the kind of clients that we're looking for. So that's helped. And then when I was first starting, I cold called some builders, and just reached out and, tried to network a little bit that way. My dad's a GC. So did some work with him. And then for the longest time, I sort of dug in my heels about creating a website because I was afraid that in doing that, I would get a bunch of junk that wasn't worth pursuing. And at first, that was definitely the case. It was like when I first started the website, my website was bad. I think my website's still mediocre. But of the 10 people that would reach out, like one of them would be worthwhile. And then I did a little bit of a website revamp. I added some, you know, some project images, some reviews from past clients, that picture of my family. And now I get a lot more good inquiries on my website. I also added an inquiry form that sort of gives me a little bit of information. And I think, you know, when people have to go through that form, it's does a little bit of self-selecting, but then I can also, you know, I know by the answers to their questions, if they're going to be a worthwhile pursuit or not. You know, I almost always offer to at least do a phone call, but at least going into that first phone call, I know like, okay, this person's not going to be the right client for me, but I can give them, you know, like I can refer them to somebody who I think would be better at helping them. So at least I'm still being useful to them in some way. But then I, again, like, so a lot of the website has been much better now in terms of quality leads with some improvements that I've made over time. But I think still a good number of my clients still come from either builder referrals or past client referrals. So it's probably at this point, it's probably like 50-50 word of mouth versus website. And then of the things that come through my website, it's probably 50-50 good lead versus bad, like garbage lead. But that's a much better ratio than it was when I first, put the website up and it wasn't as good.
It's fantastic. It's almost like as you get more clear about what you're looking for, people understand better what you can offer.
And yeah.
So what sort of things do you ask people to reflect on in that initial form, as they're submitting an inquiry to you?
Well, the primary thing is budget. You know, like I know if somebody comes to me with a $50,000 budget, it's going to be tough for me to do their project and make any money without taking a chunk of that. You know, like if they only have $50,000 to spend, chances are they're not trying to spend a big chunk of that on design, right? So those people, I try to like, I know a draftsman in town, I refer, and I know he's going to be less expensive. And usually those people, their projects are smaller and they sort of know what they want. So I can guide them.
DIY budget.
Yeah, exactly. Like I can guide them to somebody else. So at least there's somebody else's headache and not mine. But I also just like I ask them to give me, what preparation have they done? Have they, to do an addition in Massachusetts, you need to have a plot plan. So like have they got a plot plan yet? Do they understand, zoning? Can they do an addition without a variance, or are they going to need one? Like, just try to get an understanding of like, do they understand the process, or like, is there going to be a lot of education that needs to be done? And then obviously, like, I ask them for a project description. What are you trying to modify within this footprint? What are you trying to add? Get a sense of the scale of their project, and hopefully that lines up with the budget that they've provided me. And if those don't line up, then they're like, I want to add 2,000 square feet, but my budget's, $100,000. Like, well, that's not going to happen. So, like making sure that their expectations align is one of the primary things. And then it's mostly just like information collecting, phone number, address, all that stuff, so that I can put it into my database, which is just a Google Doc, or a Google
It
spreadsheet.
works.
Yeah, it's I it is I wish I had a more sophisticated way of like automating that. Like somebody takes they submit their form and that all that information automatically populates into a spreadsheet or something. And I know this is something that can be done and I just haven't got there yet. But so far it's worked for me. So I just continue to make it work because like when you run a small firm, a lot of this is just bootstrapped. You're just, like we're figuring it out on the fly and you're trying not to spend $1 billion on this and that. And we're already paying for software and whatever else. So it's like wherever you can. But then sometimes it's like, oh, I should pay for that because that has efficiencies that'll make it so I can do so much more. So we're always balancing those things. But yeah, it's the online inquiry form is helpful. Even sometimes people will call me and I just send everyone a voicemail. And my voicemail tells people, go on the website, fill out the inquiry form. That way I can sort of, screen them before I have to like engage in a conversation so I can be prepared. 'Cause there's nothing I like less than going into a conversation and like not knowing where it's gonna go. So I like to have that to be prepared. And also I'm a one man band, so my time is very finite. It's the resource that I have, so I try to be very protective of it. And by sending them to the website, having them fill out that inquiry, then I can set up a time to talk and I'm not like getting a random phone call. Like I can schedule the call, be prepared for it. And it just makes my life easier. I'm also not a big phone guy, so like I need to get myself in the right headspace to talk to someone on the phone. I don't like an impromptu call. So
I completely understand that. I'm curious what kind of boundaries and rules you've kind of set for yourself to make your business serve your life and support your family.
yeah. So because I'm a one man band and I'm trying to do a lot of things, but I also, I've got to get my kids to school. I've got to get my kids from school. So, I basically don't, if people call or text before 8 o'clock, they're not getting an answer. And then, I between like 6:30 and 8, that's get kids breakfast, get them to school, do all the things that need to be done to start the day. And then I typically come back from getting my daughter off onto the bus. And then that's when I like will answer emails or texts or whatever. And then from 9 to 10, I go to the gym every day. If I don't go to the gym,
Nice.
if I don't go to the gym, like I'm a terrible person. I have to do it for, my mental health as much as anything. So I usually block that time off. Sometimes I will, if like I really am stuck schedule wise, I'll shift that to like the lunch hour. But from 9 to 10 is usually my time at the gym. And then I come home, and then, you know, from 10:30 to 4:30 is, you know, we're locked in. We're doing, like, some days it's client meetings, some days it's just sitting and drafting, you know, or designing. Occasionally I'll take, you know, I try to do, if I'm going to do phone calls, I try to do them sort of between like 3 and 4:30. That's when I feel like I'm sort of cashed out on maybe doing some of the drafting and designing stuff and like ready to talk to people, on the phone. Then from 4:30 to 7:30, that's picking up kids, eating dinner, playing, doing bedtime, all that stuff. And then, you know, usually my kids are, you know, 3 to 7. So they're usually in bed around 7:30, or at least we're out of their room by 7:30, whether they're in bed or not. And then, I usually, again, I come downstairs and I, because I've taken that chunk of time out for the gym, because I did all that stuff, I usually work at night from like 8 to 10:30. And that time is actually some of my most productive time, because no one's calling or emailing at that time. And, you know, I don't have to worry about my kids' daycare calling and telling me they're sick or anything like that. It's very focused. And, you know, like a lot of times I throw the TV on in the background and, you know, half watch a movie or, you know, Thursday night football, whatever's on, and really like crank out some work during that time. But yeah, like I just try to keep a really fixed schedule. I never do anything on the weekends. And my wife is also an architect, and she works for, a larger company, and she has to travel a bit. So I always, and she's, just got promoted there, and she's does really well and has to do a lot of things and has a lot of responsibility. So I try to like accommodate her schedule as much as possible, because she has a little less flexibility. So, you know, like I just try to like get everything planned out for a couple weeks ahead, make sure that I have those boundaries set, and then, fill everything else in between. I do tend to take on too much or like overpromise. Like people are like, oh, can you get this done by then? And I'm like, sure. Like, maybe. And
that
and
seems possible, but then yeah, there's always these little whole things that it linger or take longer.
Exactly. Everything takes longer than you think it does. Or even if it takes as long as you think it should, something else inserts itself, you know. It's like that's when the sick kid happens or like, or whatever, that sort of like throws a kink into it. And some of it is, you know, like I'm trying to people please a little bit, which is, you know, probably not healthy, but, and some of it is just like thinking you can do it all and make it work. And like, I've gotten better about realizing what I can handle. And I've also come to realize that if you tell people no, people are like, oh, okay. Like they just, you know, like sometimes they don't have any other option, or they were asking just because you don't know unless you ask. So if you just set the boundary and tell them, they'll be like, oh, that's fine. Like just tell me when you can do it and be realistic about it, and it will all be fine. I've realized that most people are reasonable and appreciate when you set appropriate boundaries rather than overpromising and under-delivering. They prefer the opposite, under-promise and over-deliver. So I've hopefully gotten better about that.
Some of your initial questions are already trying to fuss out if they're grounded in some of the realities, if they've done some of the research to some of the constraints, and they may come into the conversation with a little bit more understanding or willingness to talk about those boundaries and look to your expertise.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the other thing I ask is always schedule, you know, like the person who thinks they're going to find an architect and like have a project in the ground in, you know, a month. We know that that's not a thing that's going to happen. Right. And also just because as I've gotten busier, like, it helps if I know people have a little bit more leeway schedule wise. If people are in a rush, it's like, yeah, maybe I can fit that in, but it's going to cost you, you know, to cut the line or whatever. So, but you don't want to do that too much either, because other people have already paid you and they have expectations that their projects are going to get done too. So gotta balance it out, I guess.
Absolutely. Well, when did you first start craft architecture?
So I started, I think my first project.
So I guess you moonlighted.
Yeah. So I started moonlighting in probably like June of 2019, I think is like when I first started taking on projects. And maybe it was a little later in 2019, because I formed my LLC in May of 2020. Because I realized I was going to have to like stamp drawings and I needed to get insurance. And like, I just like from a business perspective, I just wanted to make sure I really just wanted to make sure I was protected. So like the LLC, the insurance, like all the stuff, I got in place in May of 2020. So I'm coming up on my 5-year anniversary of that. And even then I was still working until I think August 2021 is when I finally, I just at that point I had so much side work and I had so much existential dread about going to my day job that I had a conversation with my wife and I was like, Jen, I think I can do this. I think I can do this full time. I think there's enough to make it worth it. And she was like, if you think that you can make it work, then just make it work. And it turned out, you know, like to be a giant blessing to be working on my own and have like I have the amount of flexibility that I have and the amount of autonomy. It's been like for our family really good, for my mental health, incredible. There was just a lot of like Sunday scaries when I like was like, oh my God, do I really have to go to that job again? Like working for the man. And now sometimes like, oh, it's almost Monday again. Like, let's go. My house gets a little crazy on the weekends. It's like, can we just get these kids back to school, back to daycare and have some normalcy? Yeah. Which 5 years is, you know, I think a lot of businesses don't make it that long. So I feel really, really good about that. And I've had pretty steady upward growth in that time, which is awesome. And so hopefully we'll keep it going we'll take it 1 year at a time, but hopefully, you know, it keeps going for a long time and I don't have to go back to working for the man.
You are the man.
Yeah, exactly. It's nice.
I resonate with your story so much because I'm also approaching 5 years and 3 kids at home. And I love, love, love my family. I love the flexibility working alone, but I love being an architect. And so when I get to do what I've been trained to do and I'm good at, boy, it's nice to have the space, the quiet, to just do this practice. And that's a joy. That's a privilege to be able to have work that I do enjoy. And apply the skills that I have to it. But then the chaos comes back and gotta learn that too for all of this.
Always fun.
Yep.
kids are fairly hilarious. So, you know, it makes it fun.
Oh, the stories, the 3-year-old, especially the things that are said by 3-year-olds.
My youngest he turns 3 in 5 days. And he like, just the things that come out of his mouth are just preposterous. It's like, and he's definitely like our family comedian. He's the best, but he's also just a maniac. So it drives me nuts.
Hey, real quick. What inspired you to name your firm Craft Architecture?
So I remember my first job out of school, I worked for a small company. It was 4 people. And when I first started working there, they had just changed the name of the firm because they had just undergone a change in ownership. Like, I don't want to have to change the name of the firm again if I sell it. So he's like, I just want like a name that is not my name. And so I thought about that when I was starting, even though like I'm always going to be a solo guy. I don't know that my firm's ever going to get sold. So like, I don't know how much it matters, but I wanted something that was like, you know, just to show people that it's small and I care. You know, you know, you think about like crafts and, you know, or craftsmen, and it's something that is, you know, unique and just cared for. And so that was sort of the image that I was trying to project. You know, it's a simple name, I think. And so that was, I don't know. I think my wife actually came up with it, and I was just like, she said it, and I was like, oh, that hits, like that works. That's the one. So it was one of those sort of things. I can't really take credit, I don't think.
So she gets a cut for the naming rights.
Well, so technically we are a partnership. And at first when I first started, she actually, like, she was like helping a bit, but then, like, you know, she was just doing it to help me get things off the ground. So she was like a little bit more involved. And then, like, every once in a while when I need to, like, it's great having her here, and like, she's a very talented designer. When I get sort of designer's block, she just helps shake the cobwebs loose. And like helps, we'll take a look at drawings or whatever for me, which is great. So yeah. And I think when I like formed the LLC, the lawyer was just like, oh, this will make it easier if you, put the LLC in the, like, your name, your wife's name, and the name of your trust, just to like keep it all accessible in case anything happens.
So what three words would you use to describe craft architecture?
I would say humble, personable, and sensible. Like, we're just try to keep things down to earth, keep things affordable, and get people to practical, valuable solutions to their problems. That's what we're trying to do. We're not trying to reinvent the wheel. We're not trying to design the Taj Mahal. We're just trying to get people houses that will work for them and their families, and do it in a way that isn't going to break the bank for them.
Absolutely. And it's fine to reinvent the wheel. It's fine to build the Taj Mahal, but there's other people who are doing that. And so I love how you've packaged all of this, and everything I hear, the more I hear, it just lines up so nicely, just between you personally and how that's being expressed and how you practice and the way you're serving people. Well, thank you so much for joining me.
Cool.
Thanks, Katie.
Sam Williams took flight with his own architectural practice by identifying a community of clients who were missed by other architects. He used the needs of this community to define his professional niche. Like a nuthatch, he uses his professional strengths to come at these projects to solve their problems while building a profitable practice. Like many backyard birds, he benefits from neighbors telling their friends and family about the experience. These referrals help Sam's practice spread and solve problems for more and more families needing to remodel their homes. Here are three key factors that define his nuthatch practice. First, define an authentic niche. For Sam, a big turning point in procuring projects was putting a picture of his family on his website. This revealed to potential clients that he is also a homeowner and parent to young children. This transparency built an immediate connection with clients who are in the same stage of life and looking for an architect who understands them. Several of his projects are houses of the same era as his own home. He is living through the same pressure points as his clients, trying to raise young children in a home built for a different generation. He knows where to add functional storage, mudrooms, and play space to aging housing stock. These projects may be too small for other architects or too complicated for just hiring a contractor. It's a challenging balance, but it's one he understands deeply through his own experience as a homeowner and parent. His transparency builds an honest, empathetic connection with his clients. And his clients can sense that second factor that sets him apart, a unique perspective. Much like a nuthatch, Sam approaches projects from a different angle than other architects. It is also distinct from the homeowners who feel like they are hitting their head against the same wall over and over again, but never landing on a better solution to the frustrations they face in their existing home. Sam maintains a firm grip on the project restraints. He understands tighter project budgets, the structural limitations of an existing home, and the quickly evolving needs of a growing family. His ability to grasp all of these variables enables him to examine a design problem from every angle, turning the constraints into a tool, not a barrier. This grounded approach, paired with his creative design thinking, allows him to bring fresh, thoughtful solutions to transform the everyday life of families in these homes, designing a project that fits their needs without breaking the bank. Sam applies this discretion in the design of his own firm, which brings us to our third and final point, building a lean, practical practice. To provide practical services that align with his clients' budgets, Sam's underlying architecture firm needs to stay lean. He's not adding unnecessary expenses to his business. He runs a lean practice that focuses on providing meaningful design solutions for his clients. His practice has grown without an excessive marketing budget, heavy overhead, or showy branding. He's built a firm that makes a real difference in his clients' lives. He doesn't need to over-render or complicate that message. He can simply share his clients' stories, and that sets him apart. It goes back to transparency. If you can just be yourself and do the work you do well, then there isn't any extra selling or marketing needed. Traditional firms, like traditional projects, can get more expensive when people keep adding to the problem. It is challenging to stay grounded in the fundamentals of practice so you can continue to approach projects from a unique perspective. If you are building an architecture firm like Unattach, consider flipping the traditional practice model. Spend less time selling and more time doing good design for your clients. Let people share how you have solved their problems with your unique perspective. Simply sharing that story isn't flashy, but some clients are looking for practical solutions in hard-to-reach areas. And a Unattach can meet them just where they are at. This episode was brought to you in collaboration with Entree Architect, which is a fantastic community for finding like-minded entrepreneurs who are there to support you in your business journey. Please subscribe, share, and join the Flying Solo Movement community. We are just taking flight. Please join this journey for ongoing inspiration, support, and resources. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Katie Kangas. My hope is to encourage aspiring entrepreneurs and architects to soar to new heights and embrace the freedom of flying solo.